Section 3, The Great Society, An American Story. In 1961, 61-year-old John Rath lived in a sparsely furnished room in Chicago. In the room sat a stove, a sink, a package of cereal, and a tiny icebox. The plaster on the wall was crumbling, the ceiling was cracked, and the window shades were smudged. Telling his story to an interviewer, Rath said, "I come home to an empty room. I don't even have a dog. No, this is not the kind of life I would choose. If a man had a little piece of land or something, a farm, or, well, anyway, you've got to have something. You sit down in a place like this, you grit your teeth. You follow me? So many of them are doing that. They sit down. They don't know what to do. They go out. I see them in the middle of the night. They take a walk. Don't know what to do. Have no home environment. Don't have a dog. Don't have nothing. Just a big zero." Quoted in Division Street, America. Johnson takes the reins. John Rath's life was not the image that many Americans had of their country in the mid-1960s. The United States that President Lyndon Johnson inherited from John F. Kennedy appeared to be a booming, bustling place. From new shopping malls to new roads with new cars to fill them, everything in the country seemed to shout prosperity. Away from the nation's affluent suburbs, however, was another country, one inhabited by the poor, the ill-fed, the ill-housed, and the ill-educated. Writer Michael Harrington examined the country's impoverished areas in his 1962 book, The Other America. Harrington claimed that while the truly poor numbered almost 50 million, they remained largely hidden in city slums, in rural areas, in the Deep South, and on Native American reservations. Harrington's book moved many Americans and inspired both President Kennedy and his successor, Lyndon Johnson, to make the elimination of poverty a major policy goal. The nation was prosperous, and many leaders had come to believe that the economy could be managed so that prosperity would be permanent. Thus, it would be immoral not to devote national resources to reducing human suffering. Lyndon Johnson invoked these ideals during the first dramatic days of his presidency. Immediately after President Kennedy was pronounced dead, officials whisked Johnson to the airport. At 2:38 p.m. on November 22, 1963, he stood in the cabin of Air Force One, the president's plane, with Jacqueline Kennedy on one side of him and his wife, Lady Bird, on the other. Johnson raised his right hand, placed his left hand on a Bible, and took the oath of office. Johnson knew that he had to assure a stunned public that he could hold the nation together, that he was a leader. He later recalled the urgency with which he had to act. A nation, stunned, shaken to its very heart, had to be reassured that the government was not in a state of paralysis, that the business of the United States would proceed. I knew that not only the nation, but the whole world would be anxiously following every move I made, watching, judging, weighing, balancing. It was imperative that I grasp the reins of power and do so without delay. Any hesitation or wavering, any false step, any sign of self-doubt could have been disastrous. Quoted in Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Days after the assassination, Johnson appeared before Congress and urged the nation to move on. The ideas and ideals which Kennedy so nobly represented must and will be translated into effective action, he stated. John Kennedy's death commands what his life conveyed, that America must move forward. Johnson's leadership style. Lyndon Baines Johnson was born and raised in the hill country of central Texas, near the banks of the Pedernales River. He remained a Texan in his heart and in his life. Johnson's style posed a striking contrast with Kennedy's. He was a man of impressive stature who spoke directly, convincingly, and even roughly at times. His style was more that of a persuasive and personable politician than of the elegant society man. Finding it difficult to gain acceptance from the Eastern establishment in the nation's capital, he often reveled in his rough image. Johnson had honed his style in long years of public service. By the time he became president at age 55, he already had 26 years of congressional experience behind him. He had been a congressional staffer, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a U.S. senator, Senate Majority Leader, and vice president. As he moved up the political ladder, Johnson developed a reputation as a man who got things done. He did favors, twisted arms, bargained, flattered, and threatened. The tactics he used to persuade others became known throughout Washington as the Johnson treatment. Several writers described this often overpowering and intimidating style. The treatment could last 10 minutes or 4 hours. Its tone could be supplication, accusation, cajolery, exuberance, scorn, tears, complaint, the hint of threat. It was all these together. Interjections from the target were rare. Johnson anticipated them before they could be spoken. He moved in close, his face a scant millimeter from his target, his eyes widening and narrowing, his eyebrows rising and falling. From his pocket poured clippings, memos, statistics. Mimicry, humor, and the genius of analogy made the treatment an almost hypnotic experience and rendered the target stunned and helpless. From Lyndon Johnson, The Exercise of Power. With every technique he could think of, Johnson sought to find consensus or general agreement. His ability to build coalitions had made him one of the most effective and powerful leaders in the Senate's history. A War on Poverty. As president, Johnson used his considerable talents to push through a number of Kennedy's initiatives. Before the end of 1964, he won passage of a tax cut, a major civil rights bill, and a significant anti-poverty program. Why was this powerful man so concerned about poor people? Johnson liked to exaggerate the poor conditions of his childhood for dramatic effect, but he had in fact known hard times. He had also seen extreme poverty firsthand in a brief career as a teacher in a low-income area. Johnson understood suffering, and he believed deeply in social action. He felt that a wealthy, powerful government could and should try to improve the lives of its citizens. Kennedy himself had said of Johnson, "He really cares about this nation." Finally, there was Johnson's ambition. He wanted to achieve great things so that history would record him as a great president. Attacking poverty was a good place to begin. Plans for an anti-poverty program were already in place when Johnson took office, and he knew that he would be able to command strong support for any program that could be linked to Kennedy. In his State of the Union address to Congress in 1964, barely 7 weeks after taking office, President Johnson told his audience, "Unfortunately, many Americans live on the outskirts of hope, some because of their poverty and some because of their color, and all too many because of both." Johnson concluded his speech by announcing that his administration was declaring an unconditional war on poverty in America. By the summer of 1964, Johnson had convinced Congress to pass the Economic Opportunity Act. The act established a wide range of programs aimed at creating jobs and fighting poverty. It also created a new government agency, the Office of Economic Opportunity, or OEO, to coordinate the new programs. Many of the new programs were directed at young Americans living in the inner city. The Neighborhood Youth Corps provided work-study programs to help underprivileged young men and women earn a high school diploma or college degree. The Job Corps tried to help young, unemployed people find jobs. One of the more dramatic programs introduced was VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, which was essentially a domestic peace corps. VISTA put young people with skills and community-minded ideals to work in poor neighborhoods and rural areas to help people overcome poverty. The election of 1964. As early as April 1964, Fortune magazine declared, "Lyndon Johnson has achieved a breadth of public approval few observers would have believed possible when he took office." Johnson had little time to enjoy such praise, for he was soon to run for the office he had first gained through a tragic event. Johnson's Republican opponent in the 1964 presidential election was Barry Goldwater of Arizona, a senator known for his outspoken conservatism. He set the tone for his campaign when he accepted his party's nomination, declaring, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." Few Americans were ready to embrace Goldwater's message, which was too aggressive for a nation nervous about nuclear war. On Election Day, Johnson won in a landslide, winning all but 5 southern states and Arizona. For the first time in my life, he said later, I truly felt loved by the American people. Reading check. Examining. What inspired the War on Poverty? The Great Society. After his election, Johnson began working with Congress to create the Great Society he had promised during his campaign. In the same period, major goals of the civil rights movement were achieved with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which barred discrimination of many kinds, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which ensured African Americans' right to vote. The Great Society was Johnson's vision of the more perfect and equitable society the United States could and should become. According to Bill Moyers, who served as Johnson's press secretary, Johnson admired Franklin Roosevelt and wanted to fulfill FDR's mission. To do that would require a program that would be on the same large scale as the New Deal. Johnson's goals were consistent with the times for several reasons. The civil rights movement had brought the grievances of African Americans to the forefront, reminding many that greater equality of opportunity had yet to be realized. Economics also supported Johnson's goal. The economy was strong, and many believed it would remain so indefinitely. There was no reason, therefore, that poverty could not be significantly reduced, especially when some had so much and others had so little. Johnson first elaborated on the goals of the Great Society during a speech at the University of Michigan. It was clear that the president did not intend only to expand relief to the poor or to confine government efforts to material things. The president wanted, he said, to build a better society for all, a society where leisure is a welcome chance to build and reflect, where the city of man serves not only the needs of the body and the demands of commerce, but the desire for beauty and the hunger for community. This ambitious vision encompassed a multitude of programs. In the 3 years between 1965 and 1968, more than 60 programs were passed. Among the most significant programs were Medicare and Medicaid. Healthcare reform had been a major issue since the days of Harry Truman. By the 1960s, public support for better healthcare benefits had solidified. Medicare had especially strong support, since it was directed at the entire elderly population. In 1965, around half of those over the age of 65 had no health insurance. Johnson convinced Congress to set up Medicare as a health insurance program funded through the Social Security system. Medicare's twin program, Medicaid, financed health care for welfare recipients, those who were living below the poverty line. Like the New Deal's Social Security program, both programs created what have been called entitlements. That is, they entitle certain categories of Americans to benefits. Today, the cost of these programs has become a permanent part of the U.S. budget. Great Society programs also strongly supported education. For Johnson, who had taught school when he was a young man, education was a personal passion. Vice President Hubert Humphrey once said that Johnson was a nut on education. He believed in it, just like some people believe in miracle cures. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 granted millions of dollars to public and private schools for textbooks, library materials, and special education programs. Efforts to improve education also extended to preschoolers, where Project Head Start, administered by the Office of Economic Opportunity, was directed at disadvantaged children who had never looked at a picture book or scribbled with a crayon. Another program, Upward Bound, was designed to provide college preparation for low-income teenagers. Improvements in health and education were only the beginning of the Great Society programs. Because of the deterioration of inner cities, Johnson told Congress that America's cities are in crisis. Conditions in the cities, poor schools, crime, slum housing, poverty, and pollution, blighted the lives of those who lived there. Johnson urged Congress to act on several pieces of legislation addressing this issue. One created a new cabinet agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, in 1965. Its first secretary, Robert Weaver, was the first African American to serve in a cabinet. A broad-based program, informally called Model Cities, authorized federal subsidies to many cities nationwide. The funds, matched by local and state contributions, supported an array of programs, including transportation, health care, housing, and policing. Since many depressed urban areas lacked sufficient or affordable housing, legislation also authorized about $8 billion to build houses for low and middle income people. One notable Great Society measure changed the composition of the American population, the Immigration Reform Act of 1965. For a brief time, this act maintained a strict limit on the number of immigrants admitted to the United States each year, 170,000 from the Eastern Hemisphere and 120,000 from the Western Hemisphere. It did, however, eliminate the national origins system established in the 1920s, which had given preference to Northern European immigrants. The new measure opened wider the door of the United States to newcomers from all parts of Europe, as well as from Asia and Africa. Reading check. Summarizing. What were the Great Society programs? Legacy of the Great Society. The Great Society programs touched nearly every aspect of American life and improved thousands, if not millions, of lives. In the years since President Johnson left office, however, debate has continued over whether or not the Great Society was truly a success. In many ways, the impact of the Great Society was limited. In his rush to get as much done as he could, Johnson did not calculate exactly how his programs might work. As a result, some of them did not work as well as people had hoped. Furthermore, the programs grew so quickly they were often unmanageable and difficult to evaluate. Cities, states, and groups eligible for aid began to expect immediate and life-changing benefits. These expectations often left many feeling frustrated and angry. Other Americans opposed the massive growth of federal programs and criticized the Great Society for intruding too much into their lives. A lack of funds also hurt the effectiveness of Great Society programs. The programs themselves were expensive enough. When Johnson attempted to fund both his grand domestic agenda and the increasingly costly war in Vietnam, the Great Society eventually suffered. Some Great Society initiatives have survived to the present, however. These include Medicare and Medicaid, two cabinet agencies, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, and Project Head Start. Overall, the programs provided some important benefits to poorer communities and gave political and administrative experience to minority groups. An important legacy of the Great Society was the questions it produced, questions Americans continue to consider. How can the federal government help its disadvantaged citizens? How much government help can a society have without weakening the private sector? How much help can its people receive without losing motivation to fight against hardships on their own? Lyndon Johnson came into office determined to change the United States in a way few other presidents had attempted. If he fell short, it was perhaps that the goals he set were so high. In evaluating the administration's efforts, the New York Times wrote, "The walls of the ghettos are not going to topple overnight, nor is it possible to wipe out the heritage of generations of social, economic, and educational deprivation by the stroke of a presidential pen." Reading check. Evaluating. What was the impact of the Great Society? Critical thinking skill builder. Problem solving. Why learn this skill? Imagine you have just done poorly on a chemistry exam. You wonder why you cannot do better since you always go to class, take notes, and study for exams. In order to improve your grades, you need to identify the specific problem and then take actions to solve it. Learning the skill. There are 6 key steps you should follow that will help you through the problem-solving process. Identify the problem. In the case listed above, you know that you are not doing well on chemistry exams. Gather information. You know that you always go to class and take notes. You study by yourself for about 2 hours each day for 2 or 3 days before the exam. You also know that you sometimes forget details or get confused about things as you are taking the exam. List and consider possible solutions. For example, instead of studying by yourself, you might try studying with a friend or a group. You might also study for shorter time spans to avoid overloading yourself with information. consider the advantages and disadvantages of each solution. Now that you have listed and considered the possible options, you need to choose the best solution to your problem. Choose what you think is the right solution and carry it out. Evaluate the effectiveness of the solution. This will help you determine if you have solved the problem. If you earn better scores on the next few chemistry tests, you will know that you have solved your problem. Practicing the skill. Reread the material in Section 1 under the heading Kennedy Struggles with Congress. Use that information and the steps listed on this page to answer the following questions. 1. What problem did Kennedy encounter as he tried to pass domestic policy legislation through Congress? 2. What options were available to the president in facing this opposition? What were the advantages and disadvantages? 3. Explain the solution Kennedy implemented to solve this problem. 4. Evaluate the effectiveness of Kennedy's solution. Was it successful? How do you determine this? Applying the skill. Problem solving. The Conservation Club at your school has no money to continue its recycling project. The school district allocated money to the club at the beginning of the year, but that money has been spent. As a member of the club, you have been asked to join a committee to save the Conservation Club and its projects. Write an essay describing the problem, the list of options and their advantages and disadvantages, a solution, and an evaluation of the chosen solution. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM, Level 2, provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills. Looking back, the Bill of Rights. Why it matters. In 1962, Clarence Earl Gideon was arrested for breaking into a Florida pool hall. When he asked for a lawyer, the judge refused. Defendants in Florida were not entitled to a court-appointed lawyer except in death penalty cases. Gideon then appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that the Constitution's Sixth Amendment guaranteed the right to a lawyer. In 1963, in Gideon v. Wainwright, the Supreme Court decided that the Sixth Amendment applied to both state and federal courts. The court ruled that having a lawyer in a criminal case is a fundamental right. For over 200 years, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, known as the Bill of Rights, have protected the rights of Americans. 5 of the amendments specify rights Americans have in federal court. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court extended many of these rights to the state and local levels. Steps to the Bill of Rights. During the Middle Ages, kings had great power, but to pass a new law, they usually obtained the consent of a council of important nobles. This custom of ruling with noble consent was not written into law until 1215. From Liberties to Rights. In 1215, King John of England faced a rebellion of many of the English nobles. Under pressure, he signed the Magna Carta. In this document, the king promised to all free men of our kingdom all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs, of us and our heirs forever. After 1215, the English king was expected to rule in accordance with the Magna Carta. When the Enlightenment began in the 1600s, a new idea of rights emerged. Several writers argued that kings could not give rights to people. Instead, every person was born with rights that the government could not violate. John Locke was an advocate of this new idea. His book, Two Treatises on Government, became very influential in the American colonies. In 1688, the English Parliament removed King James II from the throne. The king's overthrow became known as the Glorious Revolution. Before the new king and queen took the throne, Parliament demanded they accept the English Bill of Rights. The English Bill of Rights strongly influenced American ideas. When the American Revolution began, revolutionaries accused the British of violating many of these rights. The American Revolution. In the 1760s, in order to stop smuggling in the American colonies, the British began sending accused smugglers to vice admiralty courts. These courts had no juries. In the Declaration of Independence, Americans accused the British of depriving us the benefits of trial by jury, as guaranteed in the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights. Americans later wrote the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Bill of Rights to prevent similar abuses by the American federal government. Also, to stop smuggling, the British issued writs of assistance, authorizing officials to search private property as they saw fit. Americans later wrote the Fourth Amendment to prevent officials from conducting searches without specific search warrants. Free speech. In England, free speech was limited by laws against sedition. Sedition is the encouraging of opposition to the government. The only exception applied to Parliament. The English Bill of Rights stated that freedom of speech in Parliament ought not be questioned. The founders of the United States knew that the American Revolution could not have happened had they been unable to make speeches or print their ideas in newspapers. When the Bill of Rights was submitted, a ban on any federal law restricting free speech or freedom of the press was prominent in the First Amendment. Putting rights into the Constitution. When the Constitution was drafted, it did not include a list of rights because supporters believed the new federal government's checks and balances would protect people's rights. When the Constitution was submitted to the states for ratification, however, opponents argued that without a list of rights, the Constitution would lead to a tyrannical federal government. George Mason, who drafted Virginia's Declaration of Rights, was a leader of the opposition. To get the Constitution ratified, supporters promised a Bill of Rights. In September 1789, James Madison prepared 12 amendments to the Constitution. In wording these amendments, Madison relied heavily on Virginia's Declaration of Rights. 10 of the amendments were ratified. Together, they make up the Bill of Rights.